Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Little of This, A Little of That, a program dedicated to conversation, information, people, and places. Your host is Dan Dillman. I'm a retired academic looking for an audience. I hope you'll join us. Each program is a potpourri of items from several or all of these categories to inform, to entertain, and to amuse you. Today's program is a continuation of the previous program where I was talking about the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and I was emphasizing at that time that the borderlands is actually a zone and not a line. It's a zone that straddles that line, and within the zone there is a third culture which is neither Anglo nor Hispanic. In the northern part of Mexico, there is a certain kind of music which is characteristic of the area, and it's called Norteño music. That's N-O-R-T-E-N-Y-O, Norteño music. And I thought I would begin this segment of the Borderlands topic by letting you hear a bit about Norteño music, which emphasizes the accordion, the banjo, the guitar, and obviously some singing.
¿Qué tal si eres tú, la mujer de mi vida? Sentada a mi lado, aquí en este bar, tomándose un trago, ahogando las penas, lo mismo que yo. ¿Qué tal si soy yo el que encaje en tus días? ¿Qué tal si tus ojos se ven en los míos? ¿Qué tal si te beso? ¿Qué tal si te invito mañana a un café?
¿Qué tal si? And there we are, an introduction by Los Tigres del Norte, playing Norteño music for us. The border we know today was established as an international frontier from about the middle of the 19th century. For more than 100 years, from before 1900, Mexicans were encouraged by U.S. farmers to cross the border to work in the fields. These men and women were a primary source of agricultural labor in the Southwest and in California. To regulate the flow of field workers, the Bracero program, Mexicans working on short-term contracts, was established in 1942. This was under an agreement between the U.S. and Mexico. After 22 years and 4.5 million Braceros, the program ended in 1964. The remaining Braceros were sent home. They congregated in the border towns, and there they formed an unemployed group of workers which harmed the economy of the border towns to such an extent that the Mexican government established a program called the Border Program, whereby U.S. companies and companies from other countries were able to use the cheaper Mexican labor to produce products in Mexico, and then export the products back to the U.S. or to other countries. Unfortunately for the men, it was not the men who were employed in these new operations. It was the women. And the men continued to be an unemployed workforce. However, in 1964-1965, this was my first experience of the borderlands. I went there and I saw for myself the beginnings of what we now call globalization, whereby countries the world around are tied in a network, an economic network, which emphasized outsourcing, in which countries sent component materials to the Mexican border, and cheaper labor there in the factories that were built by the Mexican government and also the countries involved. Components were assembled and exported back to the U.S. and to other countries. These factories were referred to as maquiladoras. And the maquiladoras began to appear along the border from Matamoros, across from Brownsville, to Ciudad Juarez, across from El Paso, to Tijuana, across from San Diego. And in the maquiladoras, the principal products that were put together were electronic goods and apparel items. You may remember back in the 60s and the 70s, when Zenith televisions were very popular, that the slogan of the Zenith Corporation was, "The quality goes in before the label goes on." Well, in Matamoros, Zenith had one of these factories where the components for the TV sets were sent and assembled there. They were not referred to as Zenith in Matamoros. Instead, they were referred to as Los Electropartes de México. In Ciudad Juarez, on the other hand, RCA was making its TV sets, assembling them, and sending them back into the U.S., and RCA wasn't at all bashful about putting up a big sign identifying itself. And so, the American need for cheaper labor has defined the border culture, and has for over 40 years. Once, the border had been porous, and in many places informal and notional. People strolling across in both directions to work, to shop, to find entertainment, and to settle. The Mormons fled south across the border to escape U.S. persecution for their polygamy. Mexicans headed north for work. The border itself was relatively harmonious. There was mutual cooperation between border towns. For example, in Nogales, Arizona, the fire brigade doused a fire in Nogales, Mexico, and vice versa. In 1994, the Clinton administration activated Operation Gatekeeper, and thereafter, the border became characterized by high fences, patrol cars, and security technology, and massive deportations of illegal border crossers. Crime, the drug trade, human trafficking, cartel violence, and fears raised by the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 all created the need to tighten the borders further. And that is where we are today. The border, a front line in what sometimes seems a war, at other times, an endless game of cat and mouse. As for the reactions to Mexicans today, American nativism has a deep and ugly history. The border demographic, however, is unlike anything elsewhere in the United States. Border cities are immigrant cities. They are populated by people from all over. From San Ysidro in the west, across from Tijuana, to Brownsville in the east, across from Matamoros. The spillover means that a non-Spanish-speaking American is at a distinct disadvantage in shopping, buying gas, and eating in many U.S. restaurants, and even fraternizing with many of the workers. It isn't really Mexico over there, al otro lado, as we say on the border, on the other side. But the cultural mix occurs on the American side, too, much of which is saturated with the jolly Vida Mexicana, as well as the odious narco or drug cultura. But the old U.S. habit of crossing the border to carouse is over. In its place, one is advised not to go far outside of the Mexican border communities, to avoid venturing out of town, even to the nearer country areas where the cartel gangsters are holed up, well-armed, and predatory. One of the common denominators of Mexican towns along the border is indisputably their civic pride. We see the street sweeper and his handcart as typical of the urban scape. And the local boast is that life is quite a bit better there than in other border towns, even though a violent drug cartel might dominate the place. This our town feeling of belonging, the assertion, for example, that you were born in Reynosa, you grew up in Reynosa, and this is your home, is common. But nearer, Texas towns may also be beset by the incursions of migrants, some from the poorer states deeper in Mexico, but more commonly today from El Salvador, from Honduras, and Guatemala in Central America, where people who have been spirited across the river from Reynosa by coyotes land on the U.S. side and head northward. Migrants run through the area, pursued by the U.S. Border Patrol agents, or are held 30 at a time in safe houses until the cartels and the human smugglers can move them on. Most people on either side of the border seem to be reasonably content, going to work, going to school, living their lives, saluting their respective flags, voting in local elections, and raising their kids. They are settled. They stay at home. They merely fantasize about the country over the fence or across the river. At the same time, like a rumble on a lower frequency in an alternate reality, there is a constant skirmishing, the equivalent of a border war, as migrants, desperate, criminal, opportunistic, or tragic, attempt to get to the other side, often with the help of human smugglers, who usually are cartel members, who demand large sums of money from the migrants. And there are more than 20,000 Border Patrol agents who work day and night to thwart them. Not only men and women try to secure the border, but steel fences as high as 26 feet run for miles, shorter fences, sections of wall, vehicle barriers, drones, helicopters, bottlenecks at bridges, checkpoints on back roads and on the interstates, sniffer dogs, all are a part of the landscape on the U.S. side, especially over the Texas towns of Zapata and McAllen, where you will see vast white balloons, the sort that are deployed for anti-terrorism in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are enormous dirigibles used for surveillance, tethered to the border, listening and watching. The notion of building a wall, however, strikes most people on either side as laughable. The belief is, show me a 30-foot wall and I'll show you a 35-foot ladder. A survey this past July 2016 showed that 72% of Americans in border cities and 86% in Mexican border cities opposed the construction of walls to separate the two countries. Some say, well, the illegal entrants may swim across the Rio Grande. Well, they may if there's water in the river at that point. But quite often, the illegal entrants are using tunnels, long ones, short ones, high-tech ones, rabbit holes, rat runs, and they have been dug wherever the border is fenced, providing an alternate and very successful means of entrance. One of the longest of these tunnels was recently discovered. It ran a half a mile under the border, from the bottom of an elevator shaft in a house in Tijuana to a fenced-in lot on the U.S. side. These resemble the mile-long tunnel that led to the capture of drug lord El Chapo this past year. These tunnels are built by serious and experienced technicians. As we end this segment on the borderlands, I wanted to remind you of a little bit of history about the border. Remember that the northern one-third of old Mexico was ceded to the United States after the Mexican-American War, 1846 to 1848, provoked in 1845 by the U.S. annexation of Texas. California at that time was still sparsely settled. It was just a chain of missions on El Camino Real, or the Royal Road, of the Mexican province of Alta California, from San Diego to San Francisco Bay. And then, in 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo established the Rio Grande as the southern border of Texas, and Arizona, once part of the territory of New Mexico, did not become a state until 1912, but the straight line of its southern border was defined by the Gadsden Purchase in 1854 in an area which was inconvenient, hard to police, across Stony Hill and Dusty Dale in the desert. And so this is an area which has been an inconvenient one to reach at times. It has been an area that is not in the under the eyes of the Mexican or the U.S. federal government, as they pay more attention to other parts of the country. And so, as we leave the Mexican borderlands, we're going to look at another topic, which might be called monumental ambition. But before we look at monumental ambition, I wanted to tell you that if you'd like to know a little bit more about the borderlands, you could look at the Smithsonian Magazine, October in this year, 2016. And some of what I said is a reference to that, and a lot of what I've been telling you about the borderlands is from my own experiences and research. So, what is this about monumental ambition? Here's another article which I found in the Smithsonian Magazine in October 2016. It's about Mount Rushmore. Each year, 2 million visitors walk or roll from the entrance of Mount Rushmore National Memorial in South Dakota to the Avenue of Flags to peer up at the 60-foot visages of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt. Dedicated some 75 years ago, Mount Rushmore was intended by its creator, Gutzon Borglum, to be a celebration of not only these four presidents, but also of the nation's unprecedented greatness. "This colossus is our mark," he wrote with typical bombast. Yet Borglum's own sordid story shows that this beloved site is also a testament to the ego and ugly ambition that undergird even our best-known triumphs. Let's go back to 1914. Borglum was a sculptor in Connecticut of modest acclaim when he received an inquiry from the elderly president of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, one C. Helen Plain, about building a statue, a shrine to the South near Atlanta. When he first glimpsed the virgin stone of his canvas, a quartz hump called Stone Mountain, Borglum later recalled, "I saw the thing I had been dreaming of all of my life." He sketched out a vast sculpture of Generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and was hired. The son of polygamous Mormons from Idaho, Borglum had no ties to the Confederacy, but he had white supremacist leanings. In letters, he fretted about a mongrel horde overrunning the Nordic purity of the West, and once said, "I would not trust an Indian offhand 9 out of 10, where I would not trust a white man 1 out of 10. Above all, he was an opportunist, though. He aligned himself with the Ku Klux Klan, an organization reborn. It had faded after the Civil War. In a torchlight ceremony atop Stone Mountain in 1915. While there isn't proof that Borglum officially joined the Klan, which helped fund the project, he nonetheless became deeply involved in Klan politics. And this, according to John Taliaferro, writing in The Great White Fathers, a 2002 history of Mount Rushmore. Borglum's decision to work with the Klan wasn't even a sound business proposition. By the mid-1920s, infighting left the group in disarray, and fundraising for the Stone Mountain Memorial had stalled. Around that time, the South Dakota historian behind the Mount Rushmore initiative approached Borglum. He made an overture that enraged Borglum's Atlanta backers, who fired him in 1925. He took an axe to his models for the shrine, and with a posse of locals on his heels, he fled to North Carolina. The Stone Mountain sponsors sandblasted Borglum's work and hired a new artist, Henry Augustus Lukeman, to execute the memorial they had wanted, only adding to Borglum's bitterness. "Every able man in America refused it," he said, "and thank God every Christian," Borglum later said of Lukeman. "They got a Jew." A third sculptor, Walker Kirkland Hancock, would complete the memorial in 1972. Still, the years in Georgia had given Borglum the expertise to tackle Mount Rushmore, and he began carving in 1927 at the age of 60. He famously devoted the last 14 years of his life to the project, and his son Lincoln oversaw the finishing touches. So from supporting the Klan to memorializing Lincoln, what are we to make of that trajectory? Anyone who creates an immensely popular sculpture by dynamiting 450,000 tons of stone from the Black Hills does deserve recognition. Taliaferro says we like to think of America as the land of self-made success. But the flip side of that coin, he says, is that it's our very selfishness, enlightened perhaps, but primal in its drive for self-advancement that is the building block of our red, white, and blue civilization. And no one represents that paradox better than Gutzon Berglum. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today's program. So remember, tune in to Dan Dillman, a little of this, a little of that. We'll try to keep you entertained, informed, and amused. And to take us out today is Herb Alpert and Spanish Flea.